Welcome everybody. This is the 9th lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, organized and hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dhammadram Institute of Liberal Arts. And it is my great pleasure today to welcome Sarah Kirchberger, who will speak to us on the topic of women and Buddhism in communist China. Sarah Kirchberger is a research associate in Sinology at the University of Hamburg's Asia and African Institute. Her areas of expertise include China's political system and Chinese and Taiwanese history during the 20th century. In 1999, Sarah Kirchberger graduated with an MA degree in Sinology, political science and archaeology from the University of Hamburg, after having studied Chinese language at Taipei during 1997-1998. Following postgraduate studies in political science at Trier University, she completed a PhD degree in Sinology in 2004. During 1994 until 2003, she was a scholar of the German National Academic Foundation. From 2007 until 2010, Sarah Kirchberger served as a naval analyst with Shipbuilder Blohm & Voss in Hamburg. Originally a specialist in Chinese domestic politics and comparative government, her first monograph had been an analysis of informal institutions in China and Taiwan's politics. It was published in German in 2004. After becoming an assistant professor of Sinology at the Asia-Africa Institute at the University of Hamburg in 2010, Sarah Kirchberger began focusing on China's naval development and in 2015 published a book on this topic. She has so far published various book chapters and articles on topics including China's political system, CCP party history, Chinese domestic politics, and Chinese foreign policy. And with this introduction, I now hand over to Sarah Kirchberger.
Thank you very much for the kind invitation to be part of this lecture series. It's a great honor, of course, and also thank you everyone for attending this lecture. I'm very sorry that this is a voice only and that I'm not going to be personally present during the classroom meeting to answer your questions directly. This is because I'm going to be traveling on the 16th and there was no other way to do this. Okay, so let's get started. My task in this lecture will be to provide you some historical and political background knowledge to basically the next lecture by Esther Bianchi, who is a real specialist on Chinese Buddhist women. So what I'm going to do as a political scientist who's concerned with modern Chinese history is to describe the structure and development of the communist revolution and in what way it pertains to Buddhist women. Hopefully, these remarks will be able to help you understand a little bit better the framework within which Han Chinese Buddhism has to operate. Let me begin with a few general remarks. I must also say that I'm going to leave Tibetan Buddhism out of this lecture because we're going to have two dedicated lectures on Tibetan Buddhist women, so I think it would be not very good to try and cover this as well. Beginning with the topic at hand, the first remark has to be that the history of China during the 20th century was in general exceptionally violent. After the founding of the People's Republic in 1949, the Communist Party of China attempted no less than a complete restructuring of society down to even the cultural roots. And this whole thing happened with an aim to create essentially a new man and a new society. This had massive consequences for all the traditional social structures in China, including, of course, the Buddhist Sangha, and it also strongly affected women as a group, because the role of women in society underwent massive change. Sorry, I'm going to, yeah, this is the next slide. So to provide you a little bit of historical background, this table basically shows the major alternating phases of communist rule since 1949. The red phases are the more radical phases, the blue or gray phases, the more quiet phases. And for those of you not too familiar with 20th century Chinese history, I will now first give a brief overview of the earliest stage of communist rule, which is called consolidation of rule on the slide, and happened between 1949 and 1955. This era, which directly followed the communist takeover, is officially called socialist construction. And it's sometimes glossed over almost in the Western literature, and usually described as a relatively peaceful time compared with the directly preceding war years. However, what actually happened during those few years was a very violent restructuring of the local society that took a large toll in terms of human lives. And this restructuring, of course, directly concerns the topic of this lecture. The driver behind the land reform campaign was an attempt that was more or less successful at first to eradicate the traditional social structures and the traditional patterns of loyalty between people. My colleague Kai Vogelsang at the Asia-Africa Institute, in his recent book about China's history, has chosen the following way of characterizing this period. I cite from his book. 2 to 5 million people are estimated to have died as a result of the land reform campaign between 1950 and 1952, while other estimations say it was more than 10 million people who were killed, and by no means only landowners and rich peasants. Rather, this number encompassed also many Christians, many suspected Kuomintang collaborators, former policemen, and other so-called class enemies. The decisive factor was not the actual situation of land ownership. Rather, there were a prescribed quota of so-called privileged people that had to be liquidated within each region, ranging between 10 and 20%, depending on the locality. End of the quote. Kai Vogelsang concludes that this land reform campaign was in actuality a mass murder of the local population that was comparable in scope to Stalin's liquidation of the kulaks. What I find remarkable from a psychological perspective is that the Communist Party took care to actively involve the local population in the denunciation, the class struggle, and the killing of the so-called privileged. By appealing to envy and greed, and by scaring those who were not yet targeted, the party managed to accomplish its major aim, which was to destroy any remainders of the traditional bonds of loyalty within the local population by involving and thus making accomplices of the survivors in order to replace the old ties between people and between families with an individual loyalty to the Communist Party only. As Mao Zedong, the Chinese communist leader, has famously remarked at one point, revolution is not a dinner party. And indeed, in China, it wasn't. Sun Shuyun is a famous female filmmaker from China who grew up in the 1960s as the daughter of a communist functionary. And she also had a Buddhist grandmother who lived in the same house. She recalls from her childhood memories. I quote, In those days, there were many campaigns, one after another. Right after the revolution, for example, we, as the new government, the communists, we would make sure that none of the old people stayed on. By that I mean those who served in the old government, the landlords who were regarded as the class enemies, the bureaucrats who were in the old government, and people who served in the old army. All these people were rooted out, millions of them. Then the industrialists, the owners of shops and factories, were the next target. That was in 1954. After that, in 1957, it was the turn of the intellectuals. A million of them were sent to labor camps just because they spoke out. Then, of course, there were the people who were sent to the countryside to be re-educated. In each of these campaigns, Mao's target was 3% of the population. China had 600 million people in 1949, so 3% each time was quite big. My grandmother, that's the Buddhist grandmother who lived with her, was constantly worried that my father would become one statistic in the 3% because he was originally from a landlord family. End of the quote. Sun Shuyun describes how her Buddhist grandmother practiced her faith in private and thereby scared the whole family to death. She tried to practice kindness and generosity amidst a climate of chaos and violence. She recited Buddhist formula. At the time, this seemed reckless to Sun and her parents, and they did not appreciate what the grandma did and frequently scolded her for behaving that way. The land reform, with the land requisition, land redistribution, of course, strongly affected the entire Buddhist Sangha, because most Buddhist temples at the time depended economically on their land and its rent. The temple elders were also classified as landowners and as part of the exploitative class. To show the magnitude of the change that was inflicted upon China as a whole and upon women and the Buddhist Sangha in particular by this massive communist revolution, I will start by describing a few constants of Chinese culture of the directly preceding era. As you can see, I structured the remainder of the lecture into four parts. The last of the four parts, however, will only be touched by me very briefly, since I expect that Esther Bianchi will elaborate on that much more competently than I could hope to do. So let's start with the first point, and with traditional Chinese ideas of femininity and womanhood. Traditional Chinese notions of womanhood and the role of women in society had always reflected a deeply ingrained patriarchalism. The likely reason for this is that China has since antiquity had a tradition of ritualistic ancestor worship, that is, the sacred duty of all the male direct descendants of any clan or family. Women are traditionally thought to be subordinate to the men, and they are therefore, of course, also not able to perform these ancestor worship rituals. Women were also not equal before the law, and they were punished much more heavily for the same crimes than a man would be. To give an example, adultery was punishable by death, and women who were raped or sexually assaulted were expected to fight to their own death or to commit suicide right afterwards to prove their innocence before the law. Otherwise, they would be sentenced for adultery. This means that a woman who was raped or assaulted had basically no chance to escape death, either by being killed for adultery, if she dared to survive, or through suicide. The latter option would, however, redeem her memory posthumously. So in many ways, ancient Chinese models of ideal womanhood center around chastity and seem somewhat familiar in the context of what we've already heard in the first lecture by Bhikkhu Nalayo about women, for instance, in ancient India. To give a textual example from Chinese antiquity, I'd like to show you a 1st century BC text from the Lianyu Zhuan by Liu Xiang, a Han Dynasty official, who wrote a compilation of biographies of virtuous women who are being extolled as examples, positive examples. It's a collection of biographies of historical women which later became a standard work that was used in women's education, basically for the whole imperial era. So let's have a look at one of these biographies. It's the second biography in the 4th chapter, which is titled The Chaste and the Obedient. And it describes the voluntary death of a 6th century person, 6th century BC, a widow named Boji, in the following way. I quote, Boji was a widow. Once she found herself at night in a house that had caught fire. Those nearby cried, Lady, flee. But Boji said, the rule for women is that when the matron and the governess are not present, they do not leave the house at night. So I await the coming of the matron and the governess. Then the story goes on to say that the matron arrived, but the governess did not, and so Boji continued to stay in the burning house until the fire reached her and she died. The story concludes with the words, thus did Boji fulfill to the utmost the duty of wifehood. We see here, I think, a strange resemblance to the old Indian ideas of ideal widowhood. From the point of view of the family, women became part of the husband's family after their marriage and were therefore considered worthless to the birth family in terms of ancestor worship rituals, and well, they had certain value because they could be used to forge new family connections, new family ties through the marriage. So arranged marriages for daughters were the norm, and their status in the husband's family then depended upon their ability to produce male children. For women, there was the rule of being subjected throughout their lives to the so-called three obediences, san song. First, they had to be obedient to the father, then to the husband, and as a widow, at last, to their son. Only as the widowed mother of at least one son, and as the highest ranking woman in a household, could a woman hope at the end of her life to at last achieve some sort of independence from other people's interference. Joining a nunnery and becoming a nun, of course, theoretically offered women a way out of this system, but since women had no right to determine their own fate and could just be married away against their will, this was not really an option for most women to take. The social role and even the physical range of movement that was available to women in Imperial China in the public was severely restricted throughout the entire Imperial era. And there is even a very fitting physical symbol for this. As you probably are aware, starting from the Song Dynasty, that was about 1000 from the year 1000, the custom of foot binding took hold in China, and this put a physical obstacle in the way of women's mobility. So, to show you a few pictures, maybe you can imagine how difficult it is to walk on such crippled feet. This intentional crippling of young girls' feet was later fought against by various governments, and it was also made illegal in the 20th century, but The last cases of young girls having their feet bound were still being reported in the 1950s in some areas. The legal status and the societal role of women changed, however, markedly after the empire came to an end. The Republic of China, which was established in 1911, finally granted women many of the modern rights that we are accustomed to, such as having the right to freely choose their own marriage partner, equality before the law, economic rights, and so on. Nevertheless, even under communism, in China's society, we can still to this day find some lingering remnants of the old prejudices against women. Looking, for instance, at the power center of the political system, one must conclude that the Chinese Communist Party is very clearly a male-dominated organization. Of its about 83 million party members, only 23% are female. However, the higher up in the hierarchy one looks, the smaller the female percentage becomes. In the Central Committee, the last one was chosen in 2012, only 16% of the full members are women. In the Politburo, there are only two women alongside 21 other members. And no woman has ever served as a member of the Politburo Standing Committee, which would be China's highest leadership organ, during the entire past 60 years. Among local cadres, local leadership cadres, the woman quota is also very low and is estimated to be around 5%. So it's clear from this alone that the political system is still very much a man's world. And this kind of calls into question China's true commitment to the communist ideal of gender equality, especially when comparing this situation with the situation of women in politics in capitalist Taiwan, which has just elected a female state president. So looking at China's society, despite numerous advances for women in terms of their legal rights, their living conditions, their reproductive health, and also their ability to participate in the workforce, there are still clearly a few remnants of old misogynist ideas detectable. The most drastic symptom of this problem is probably the very large gender gap, which means the fact that many more children of a male gender are born in China than female children, leading to a very uneven gender distribution in demographics today. One major factor causing this is selective abortion. This problem became most acute as a result of the one-child policy, which was adopted in 1978. Daughters, as I already explained, were traditionally considered more or less worthless to the family, as it is traditionally the lot of the oldest son and his wife to support the aging parents and to perform the ancestor worship rituals, while the daughters are married away and become part of another family. And so, many newborn girls, after the adoption of the one-child policy, over the decades were either killed or abandoned after birth, and many female fetuses were selectively aborted if an ultrasound exam during the pregnancy revealed the female gender of the fetus. All these discriminatory practices are forbidden by law in China, but they are very difficult to eradicate in practice. On this photograph, you can see a roadside sign in Sichuan, rural Sichuan, that says it's forbidden to discriminate against, to mistreat, and to abandon baby girls. And the existence of such signs at the side of the road basically proves that these unfortunate things still happen on a regular basis. China's National Population and Family Planning Commission officially estimates that there will be 30 million more men than women in China by 2020. So the government is actually worried that this could lead to social instability when increasing numbers of young men can't find a woman to marry, which might increase certain types of crimes such as kidnapping and sex trafficking. It could also cause young men to emigrate. Okay, so now turning to the topic of Buddhist notions of a female birth being somehow bad that we've already heard about in the first lecture, for instance, the one about karma of female birth, I must say that I have found symptoms of this same type of thinking also described in the literature on China. I would like to very shortly present the results of a recent ethnographic study that was done among Hakka Buddhist lay women in Ninghua in southeastern China, the Fujian province, where Nikki Zhang describes a particular local ritual that is called Jiezhu, receiving a prayer bead or receiving the mala. And this ritual is performed by women upon reaching the age of menopause, and it is supposed to cleanse them from the filthiness of the female bodily existence. According to Zhang, the so-called uncleanliness of the female body relates to two things. First, sexual desire is said to be aroused in men by a female body, by the female body, and this body is therefore regarded as being responsible for sexual temptation, which Buddhists are, of course, required to refrain from. And second, menstruation and childbirth, basically the bodily discharges of the female anatomy, are presumed by these people to make a woman polluting to the environment and to other people. So according to Zhang, the local Hakka lay Buddhist view is that the nature of women is morally defective and that they have to be indeed reborn as men before they can ever attain Buddhahood. As to the curious view of the female bodily discharges, there she explains that menstrual blood is seen as dangerous because of it having the potential to become a person and is thus likened to a dead person who has not lived. I must confess I don't fully understand what is meant by that. I'm just reporting the findings. Childbirth is also seen as defiling, however. So giving birth to a live child is also defiling. In this Ninghua locality, therefore, menstruating women and pregnant women and also new mothers are seen as a menace to the sacred. They are not allowed to light an incense stick or to enter a temple. Moreover, it is also thought to be bad luck for others to sit on a chair that has previously been occupied by a menstruating woman or by a new mother. And brides avoid encountering pregnant women on the street because it is said to bring bad luck to them. Therefore, the age of reaching menopause, when menstruation ceases and fertility ends, is seen as a blessing by these Hakka women because effectively this frees them from numerous taboos and restrictions. Through this Jiezhu ritual of receiving prayer beads, they receive a mala and they receive a new Buddhist name, so-called Forming, and this name they also use socially, whereas before they were effectively nameless in public sphere. only using their husband's family names, Mrs. Chen or Mrs. Wang, or a family title such as auntie or granny in public, but never their own given name. I find this study very interesting because the prejudice and also the fear concerning the female reproductive organs is surprisingly strong in this example. And moreover, this is a description of the current social situation. It's not historic, which shows that there are still very many negative stereotypes and also curious superstitions attached to the female anatomy among a group of Buddhist lay practitioners even today. So this Dieju ritual was apparently even performed in secret during the Cultural Revolution, which was a time in China when all so-called feudal superstitions were strictly prohibited. From this we can see how deeply ingrained in local society such customs and ideas truly seem to be. I'd like now to return to the communist attempt at transforming traditional Chinese society, including the rise of Buddhist notion. Maoist evaluations of Buddhism and of religion in general, and then I'll try to explain how the Chinese communists attempted to create a new social order for China. After that, I'll describe what this meant for the Buddhist Sangha and how Buddhists at the time tried to cope with it. So as many of you probably know, the basic Marxist notion of religion is that religion is completely dependent on a society's mode of production. It is part of the so-called superstructure that develops, according to Marxism, only as a result of a particular economic base. In 1859, Karl Marx wrote, "The mode of production of material life conditions the general process of social, political, and intellectual life. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their existence, but their social existence that determines their consciousness." So the economy, and in particular the modes of production and the patterns of ownership, are seen as the factors that determine people's consciousness. What this meant in practice is that, for instance, land ownership, such as the land owned by Buddhist temples, constitutes the economic basis for creating a so-called feudalist ideological or religious superstructure. So coming to Mao Zedong, the most influential Chinese thinker in communism, Mao's thinking has of course been largely aligned with this very basic Marxist viewpoint that I just described. In 1938, Mao wrote the following thing that you can see on that slide about Buddhism. It's a quote from his text Dialectical Materialism. He wrote, "Christianity says that God created the world, Buddhism and all of China's various fetishist religions attribute the movement and development of all the myriad phenomena to spiritual forces. All of these doctrines are fundamentally incompatible with dialectical materialism." So this is probably not surprising that this will be a communist view on religion, including Buddhism. I actually searched the entire writings of Mao for references to Buddhism, and I found only a handful, and almost all of them are part of my lectures. So Buddhism was not a topic that Mao wrote a lot about. He's surprisingly silent on it, actually. Anyway, in another text from 1940, named On New Democracy, a very famous text by Mao, he elaborated a little further. In that text, Mao wrote, "New democratic culture is scientific, opposed as it is to all feudal and superstitious ideas, it stands for seeking truth from facts. On this point, the possibility exists," writes Mao, "of a united front against imperialism, feudalism, and superstition between the scientific thought of the Chinese proletariat and those Chinese bourgeois materialists who are progressive, but in no case is there a possibility of a united front with any reactionary idealism. In the field of political action, communists may form a united front with some idealists and even religious people, but we can never approve of their idealism or religious doctrines." So this was written during the so-called anti-Japanese war, and the so-called United Front refers to the efforts of forging a national front against the Japanese and of uniting all forces in society under this umbrella, and of course behind the leadership of the Communist Party. So ultimately, this text already showed that before the revolution in 1949, the communist view finds Buddhism alongside all the other so-called feudal superstitions and fetishist religions fundamentally incompatible with a correct or scientific worldview. And one has to concede that this line of thinking is in line with the general intellectual trend in China that started already during the Republican era, 1911, of secularism, where the national government had already started to differentiate more strongly between so-called organized religions, 宗教, and superstitions, 迷信. And there was a large-scale conversion movement already in the Republican era that converted temples to schools and other types of public buildings during that Republican time. For instance, in Jingxian and Hebei province, we know that there have been about 430 temples in the year 1900, but only 116, a little more than a quarter, of them remained 15 years later. Buddhists at that time already began to organize themselves into larger federations to counteract such attempts at reducing their landholdings and other Buddhist venues. Much later, after the founding of the People's Republic and on the eve of the Great Leap Forward, end of the 1950s, Mao then said the following thing about Buddhism. He said, "Having cleared away blind faith, we no longer have any spiritual burdens. Buddhas are made several times life-size in order to frighten people. Marxism-Leninism looks at everyone on equal terms, and all people should be treated as equals." This quote just shows that Mao apparently thought that Buddhism was primarily a means to frighten people. Before and during the communist liberation, as it is called, influential Buddhist leaders nevertheless thought it was possible, or rather they hoped to be able to cooperate with the communists for the sake of preserving the Buddhist Sangha. They were probably encouraged to think that this might be possible by certain utterances that had been made by communists during the Civil War about a possible united front of all progressive forces in China even among the religious people, such as the one that I have already mentioned and such as the following one, which Mao had made in 1945. In 1945, Mao had, in his text on coalition government, basically given a statement in favor of religious freedom, where he said that all religions are permitted in China's liberated areas in accordance with the principle of freedom of religious belief. All believers in Protestantism, Catholicism, Islamism, Buddhism, and other faiths enjoy the protection of the people's government so long as they are abiding by its laws. Everyone is free to believe or not to believe. Neither compulsion nor discrimination are permitted. So this sounded relatively encouraging to many religious people at the time. However, unfortunately, there can be no doubt that in the long run, the party expected people to shed their feudal superstitions, as it was called, and to become true atheists. And some so-called progressive Buddhists at the time, the most prominent perhaps the Venerable Juzan, who had Marxist leanings and who later became active in the leadership of the Chinese Buddhist Association before himself becoming a victim of class struggle during the Cultural Revolution, attempted to reconcile Buddhist doctrine with Marxist ideas. As Xu Yu has remarked in a recent study on this particular phenomenon, I quote from Xu Yu's study now, progressive Buddhist thinkers in the early 1950s enthusiastically sought to discover Buddhism in Marxism and to recreate a Buddhism based on Marxism. However, only Marxist criticisms of religion were allowed, while the Buddhist criticism of Marxism was strictly forbidden. To a large extent, Buddhists avoided such criticism and ignored the differences. Instead, they devoted their efforts to searching for common ground, scientific, not feudal and reactionary, but eminently compatible with Marxism. End of the quote. A letter written by the Venerable Juzan and 21 other eminent monks to Mao Zedong himself, offering their complete support to the new people's government and praising Buddhism's similarity to Marxism, receive no answer. In a very recently published study of Juzan's policy, Xu Yu remarks, you can see on the slide, according to Mahayana doctrine, observed the leading progressive monk Juzan, for Buddhists to support Chairman Mao is not just a right, but an obligation. That was what Juzan publicly said. He further noted, for the welfare of all beings, for the benefit and happiness of the world, for supreme and perfect enlightenment, we unreservedly and unconditionally, yet not aimlessly or in an unprincipled manner, support Chairman Mao, the savior of the people of all nations and religions. So Mao is here even called a savior, which seems rather an extreme degree of veneration extended to Mao Zedong by this monk Juzan and other It is possible that Juzan and the other progressive Buddhists like him had the hope that this show of loyalty would be rewarded and the Sangha preserved. By clearly taking sides with the new people's government and pledging allegiance to the communists against the so-called class enemies, it seemed to them that Buddhism could perhaps prove to be a worthy ally
to the ruling Communist Party. Mao seems indeed to have extended them some sort of invitation to Buddhists specifically in his remarks dating from August 1952 that were titled "Let Us Unite and Clearly Distinguish Between Ourselves and the Enemy." This is a very central point of this communist worldview. There is always an enemy that one has to guard against and defeat. In this text, Mao said the following thing: "It is necessary to carry out education among the democratic parties and in religious circles so that they will not be taken in by the imperialists," that would be the Americans, by the way, "and stand on the enemy's side. Take Buddhism, for example. It has not much contact with imperialism, not much contact to the US, and its ties are chiefly with feudalism. As the struggle against feudalism involves the land problem, it affects the monks, and those who come under attack are the abbots and the elders of the monasteries. Once this small number is overthrown, ordinary monks will be emancipated." So here we can see that there's a struggle between ordinary monks and elders is envisaged. Mao continues, "Though no believer in Buddhism, I am not against forming an association of Buddhists to get them united and enable them to distinguish clearly between the people and the enemy. We should unite with everyone, provided he truly makes clear distinction between the people and the enemy concerned." According to Xu Yu's research on the Venerable Juzhan, this particular Buddhist leader reacted to this by willingly letting Buddhist monastics be labeled non-proletarians, which means that they were seen collectively as part of the exploitative class, and this in the middle of an ongoing class struggle movement. Basically, according to Xu Yu, Juzhan argued in the following way: "Having received the kindness of Mao and other communist leaders, monks and nuns should repay them by willingly undertaking socialist transformation of their feudalist nature. The first step was to admit, according to the research of Xu, that they had in fact lived parasitic lives before, and to repent for this through self-criticism." At one point, a monk asked the Venerable Juzhan whether monastic members shouldn't be considered proletarians because they had already renounced the world and given up worldly things, but Juzhan categorically rejected this idea. He pointed out that monastic members in China had not lived their lives begging for food, nor had they participated in agriculture, and although an ordinary clergy might not be taken for the feudal class, they certainly could not be considered members of the proletariat because they had benefited from the rent of temple lands without themselves tilling this land. Abbots, on the other hand, were representatives of temples, and they belonged to the landowning class because anyone who did not perform productive labor was a member of that exploitative class. The utterances are taken from Xiandai Huoxue magazine that was founded at the time. This attempt to accommodate the communists went even farther than that. The Venerable Juzhan, for instance, argued that monks and nuns should willingly enter productive activities, become workers in factories, and he even argued that they should volunteer, monks and nuns, for military service in the Chinese anti-American war effort in Korea. And he maintained that taking part in this war was to be seen as a form of justified killing. And this is, of course, a very serious departure from Buddhist doctrine that is very problematic to justify. So we can see that the progressive Buddhists went out of their way to be accommodating, and they hoped, no doubt, that this gesture would be appreciated and the Sangha would not be seen as an enemy of the people. Unfortunately, these attempts to secure a place for Buddhism in the new order were ultimately not successful during the Mao era. Juzan and his peers probably underestimated the radicality of the new regime, and they probably misunderstood the aims of the Communist Party, which ultimately did not see any future for Buddhist life in China. Juzan himself came under attack as a counter-revolutionary during the Cultural Revolution and was detained, imprisoned from 1967 until 1980, and died only 4 years later. Therefore, sadly, the conclusion that Yu draws from these studies is that, I quote, "Chinese Buddhists' collaboration with the communist regime actually helped shape the socialist transformation of the Chinese Sangha, a process that laid the foundation for full-scale persecution of Buddhism during the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and 70s. So, to turn to a new topic, I think it is important to understand a little better some key characteristics of Chinese communist rule besides the Marxist ideological viewpoints on religion that I have already described. So let me now turn to some of the organizational principles and tenets and the actual practice of ruling that affects all social organizations in China and all religious organizations to this day. The key principle for organizing the communist state in China was directly adopted from the Russian leader Vladimir Lenin, who had led the first ever successful socialist revolution in the world. Lenin had devised principles for the establishment of a revolutionary organization that was essentially a secret society, not unlike a terrorist cell, and had explained these principles in a pamphlet named What is to be Done. What emerged from Lenin's writings and from his actual revolutionary practice was the main principle called democratic centralism, which is much more centralist than it is democratic. Basically, this principle calls for a party composed of members of undying loyalty of every single party member towards the party leadership, and for a strict military hierarchy within this organization, a strict adherence to secrecy towards outsiders, and unquestioning obedience to any orders coming from the higher echelons. The aim of Lenin was to create an organization that would be able to survive in a hostile environment, to take over power in the state, and afterwards to pervade the whole state and the whole society with its organization in order to prevent any attempts by rival organizations to subvert the state. So this is the background one needs to have in mind. The idea was to have many completely independent party cells at the grassroots level that would perhaps not even know of each other, but that would effectively pervade all social organizations and would be subordinate to the party groups at a higher hierarchical level. In this model that you can see here, you see the pyramid structure of the party, the strict hierarchy, and you can see on the left side that free discussions before a central decision is made public to the party members is theoretically allowed. In practice, it was mostly not allowed, but in theory it was. And after the party central has declared its policy, then strict obedience is a requirement. The punishments against transgressions were very severe. Members of the party are thus effectively functioning like soldiers in an army, expected to carry out orders unquestioningly. This ideal type of an organization, which I just described, is called Leninism, and it has been widely copied by communist movements all over the world. Today, China's Communist Party has over 83 million people, million members, 83 million members. This party organization, this state party, actively tries to co-opt the most gifted people, the most gifted students, and successful elites, even nowadays successful private entrepreneurs, into the party. So it tries to be an elitist organization of the most advanced echelons of society. Most membership applications to the Communist Party are actually rejected, and successful applicants are scrutinized, undergo a two-year probational period, and only afterwards effectively become immune before the law. That's one of the benefits of being a party member. You can't just be punished by a court. The party has to give permission that you are expelled from the party before you can actually become, well, sent to prison by a court of law. The preamble of the Chinese state constitution actually contains a passage that states that the Chinese Communist Party leads the state. So it is an organization that stands effectively above the state. It is the true sovereign of the Chinese state. The political system that was set up in China after the revolution is therefore fully under party control. All the state organs, every administration, every state-owned enterprise, every federation, every school, every university, and of course every military unit has a party cell that effectively controls this organization and reports directly to the next higher level of the party leadership. The party thus creates a shadow hierarchy that pervades the entire country. So the flow of authority in China is always from the party organization on the same level to the state or societal organization on the same level. All political power in China is effectively concentrated within the Standing Committee of the Politburo, which has currently only 7 exclusively male members. Organizations that are concerned with overseeing religious activities, such as with local branches in various affected localities. Several official organizations today take part in the administration of religious affairs, including Buddhism, on various different levels, national, provincial, or local levels. The Commission of Religious Affairs, the United Front Work Department, and the Buddhist Association. There is, however, a great gray area today of unofficial organizations that are not strictly sanctioned but are tolerated so long as their activities are seen as non-threatening in a political sense and as beneficial for society, for instance, by providing social services. So, after describing these basic characteristics of the state system, how did Buddhism fare under this type of communist rule, especially given Mao Zedong's very radical utopian experiments that followed in the 1950s and the 1960s, as you can see on this table?
to describe this from a Buddhist perspective, I have chosen to give you some quotes from eyewitness accounts dating from the 1960s. But to illustrate this with a few pictures, here you can see examples of contemporary propaganda materials next to photographs of the actual conditions. Here on this slide during the Great Leap Forward, and on the next slide during the Cultural Revolution. The following observations that I'm going to cite are again from the recollections of the filmmakers Sun Shuyun, who was already mentioned, the female film producer who was born in the 60s and grew up during this time, who had a Buddhist grandmother, but her parents were atheists and communist functionaries, and she grew up with this mindset. During a lecture in 2005, Sun Shuyun recalled this time in the following way. I grew up in China in the 1960s, and many of you will know what a strange time that was. Just about everything was turned upside down, and Buddhism was very much a synonym for anything that was bad about our society. Buddhism was regarded as feudal, reactionary, and as something that gave China a lot of its old evils. In primary school, we had compulsory classes on political studies 3 times a week, during which times we studied Mao's works, and religion was always a target of attack. Communism regarded Buddhism, I would say, as the main competitor for the control of faith, for the control of people's minds. Indeed, we had a saying, one more Buddhist, one less communist. Throughout China, even today, the one thing that you can definitely see in most villages and cities is a temple. It could be very small or big as a palace, and this, I think, is the symbol of Buddhism. So this is what Sun Shuyun describes from memory, how religion was constantly attacked, but she recalls Buddhism as being particularly strongly attacked and suspects that the communists actually feared Buddhism as a potential rival for people's faith. Are quite interesting. Sun also recalls in some detail the destruction of the Buddhist Sangha during the so-called Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. You can see 2 photographs here, and the struggle meetings were individual people who were identified as counter-revolutionaries or class enemies were publicly humiliated, fought against, sometimes tortured and killed. This happened also to very many monks and nuns. Sun Shuyun goes on to recall this, and she basically describes the process starting from 49 in the following way. Very soon after 1949, when the Communist Party came to power, one of the first things that they did was to remove 2 symbols of Buddhism, the monastery, the outward symbol, and the monks and nuns who wore orange robes and who could be seen throughout the country. I have to ask you for a tiny moment of patience because I have to... The power of my notebook is going to fail very soon, so I will just replace the cable. Just a moment. Okay. Very sorry, I forgot to attach the power line. Okay, so they removed these 2 symbols of Buddhism. The monks and nuns disappear from public view, and the monasteries were dismantled. Sun also says that prior to 49, China had about 250,000 temples. But by the end of the Cultural Revolution, in 1976,
there were only about 100. She says that they were not preserved because they were Buddhist temples, they were preserved because they were important historical or cultural or archaeological monuments and very old. But the other form of destruction that was maybe even more harmful to the Sangha, of course, was the physical removal of, she writes, the great masters and teachers. Sun says, we have a saying in China, if you want to kill a snake, you have to cut off the head. And the great masters used to have and still have an extraordinary number of followers, and it has been a consistent policy of the government to remove them. First, they were sent to labor camps, then to prisons, and then they were killed. Sun says that she thinks that the whole country, by 2005, had no more than 5 really good Buddhist teachers dating from pre-1949. The death of Mao in 1976 finally ended this radical and violent phase in China's history, which had brought unfathomable suffering to millions of people. A full 3 decades after the founding of the new China. In 1978, 100 million people in the countryside were still on the brink of starvation, according to official statistics. Can this really be socialism? Exclaimed one central cadre named Wan Li after visiting the impoverished peasants of Anhui province in the late 1970s for the first time. This situation of poverty changed only when 2 years after Mao's death, Deng Xiaoping emerged victorious from a succession struggle and laid the foundation of the reform era that we can see today, which has brought unprecedented wealth to large parts of the Chinese population. But the Leninist power structure that I have described before as an ideal type, including the political control mechanisms and the shadow hierarchies that pervade the entire society, still remains firmly in place, and every challenge to the party's monopoly of power has since been met with violent suppression, as was, for instance, visible in 1989 during the Tiananmen incident and many other instances as well. Meanwhile, however, many ordinary Chinese experience a spiritual crisis of sorts. Communism as an ideology has been quietly pushed into the background. The economic practices that were adopted by the new government to counter poverty seem to contradict the principles of socialism. They are basically capitalist methods, while the increasing wealth gap between the winners and the losers of the reform also shows a clear departure from the ideals of fairness and egalitarianism that communism holds. So many people report feeling lost in the face of increasing consumerism. You can see here a quote by a philosophy professor at a well-known Shanghai University, who basically says that, to quote him verbatim, on the surface we've achieved the goals, but no one is happy. There is no love, no hope. For more than 100 years, we Chinese have been trying to catch up with Western countries. We want science, technology, and military power, but the most important thing is the soul of the culture. The mind is based on the soul, and we've lost our souls. So there's just one voice, obviously, among many, and there are, of course, winners in the reform era that would not perhaps attach sort of importance to spiritual values. But many people have said similar things, and it is a fact that wealth has not eliminated
China's social problems. Rather, it has created a fair number of new ones. And as a result, perhaps of this situation, interest in Buddhism and in other religious communities and religious traditions has basically exploded during the past three decades. About 185 million Chinese now follow Buddhism. This is a finding of the Center of Religion and Chinese Society at Purdue University in the US that was published in 2010. But according to a different survey that was done by a Chinese research center for religious cult at East China Normal University, they found that, through questionnaires, they found that 33% of the people taking part in the survey in 31 different provinces claim to believe in Buddhism. So one-third of the survey population claim to be Buddhist. Liu Zhongyu, the research team's leader, said that Buddhism is the major belief among intellectuals and young people in China. He said that there are more than 300 million Chinese who are likely to believe in Buddhism. 10 years earlier, the official statistics of the State Bureau of Religious Affairs had put this number much lower, at 100 million. Liu Zhongyu attributed the growing interest in Buddhism primarily to social instability, to pressures and anxiety caused by the rapidly developing market economy in China. So changing situation caused uncertainty. The Chinese Academy of Social Sciences Blue Book on China's religion said that Buddhism has basically experienced a golden period during the reform era, the three decades of reform. During this period, nationwide organizational systems have been created and Buddhists have conducted summer camps and public education activities in all parts of the country. This development was also commented upon by Sun Shulin, the filmmaker that I've already quoted several times. She has observed the following things. From the mid-1980s, when I left university, Buddhism grew fast. From 1985 to 1995, just in a decade, about 25,000 temples were rebuilt in China, mostly in the coastal areas, in the rich areas, where people give large donations. If the party allows it, I think each village could now have three monasteries. The joke of it is, however, that the principal task of a party official in charge of religious affairs in China is to try to stop monasteries and temples being built in a particular place. Sun Shuyuan says that if you as a party official allow a temple to be built or to be repaired in your county, then you won't become promoted to the municipal level. In the case of the city, you won't go up to the provincial level. So the party officials, according to her, basically compete with each other to see who is the most successful, most notorious in cutting down the number of temples that are being built. There are nevertheless now numerous Buddhist communities and activities throughout China, and many people, among them very many women, participate in Buddhist summer camps. They connect with Buddhist teachers, sometimes via the internet. They distribute pamphlets to gain merit. Or they might practice meditation at home alone while studying manuals that they have bought in regular bookshops. They come from all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds and from all Chinese regions. Han Chinese connect with teachers in Tibet or in Hong Kong or Taiwan or further abroad. The state has so far tolerated the huge Buddhist revival for the most part, not least because of the philanthropic services that are provided by many Buddhists in poor areas.
where this is seen as beneficial for harmony or society. Today's Buddhist communities are, in fact, extremely multifaceted, and I will now conclude this lecture to leave the remainder of this topic of Chinese Buddhist women and their life in more detail to an expert, and that would be, of course, an expert that will present in the next week. So thank you again for attending my lecture, and as I already said, I'm extremely sorry that I can't be here to answer everyone's questions. I do hope that I've managed to make clear under what kind of political framework the Buddhist Sangha has to operate in China during the past 60 years, and what kind of political influences are still at work that continue to shape it today. Thank you.
Ich habe ausgeschaltet. Ganz herzlichen Dank. Jetzt gucke ich mich noch mal eben hier rein. Ach, da ist eine Frage. Tja. Jetzt ist die Frage da, aber jetzt habe ich schon ausgeschaltet, weil ich dachte, da kommt nichts mehr.
Ja, ich kann ja die Frage, also hast du schon ausgeschaltet. Soll ich denn dann im Chat antworten, oder wie?
Yeah, I think that if we leave it for the chat, I had the feeling that you were...